Hey, Inside Appalachia fans, we have some pretty exciting news to share. We've just launched our very first TV episode of Inside Appalachia. The one-hour program hears from people who were affected by this year's historic floods. We'll hear how they're looking to rebuild their homes and their communities. You can watch the full episode on wvpublic.org coming this Sunday. Welcome, Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The summer is winding down, and folks across Appalachia and the country are gearing up for school. But figuring out which backpack to get for the year isn't the only thing some families are considering. On today's show, we'll hear how the natural gas industry is affecting communities in the region. Also, we've talked before about the growing trend in Appalachian cuisine, but there could be a downside. That's on this week's Appetite Appalachia segment. But first, we're going to hear a special report about environmental concerns surrounding the production and transportation of natural gas. There are thousands of gas wells in the Marcellus Shale of Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia, and a growing number of pipelines helping to move that gas around the Northeast. So how many of these pipes are leaking methane or potent greenhouse gas? Scientists have been trying to find out the answer since the start of the fracking boom. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier tagged along with a team of researchers trying to answer that question.
Actually, a blue line with this green line, but you can't even see it anymore.
Naomi Zimmerman is checking a computer screen inside a white van that looks like it came straight from an episode of Storm Chasers. Zimmerman is leading a team of researchers from Carnegie Mellon University looking for methane here in the rolling hills of northeastern Pennsylvania. Computer monitors and expensive sensors are mounted inside the team's van, wind and weather probes on the outside. All told, there's $500,000 of equipment on the rig. To start her day, Zimmerman must first make sure the team's monitors are calibrated correctly. On a screen mounted to the dashboard, she reads off her levels.
So we're seeing readings of 0, 0.16, negative 0.1, /0.1, 1.4. That's approximately 0. Good enough for...
With their rig checked out, the team is ready to roll. A few years ago, northeastern Pennsylvania was one of the hottest drilling spots in the country. Now, most of the rigs here are gone, but there are thousands of wells already drilled. And the hills and dairy farms around the region are crisscrossed with pipelines, compressor stations, and other infrastructure siphoning gas away from those wells. The team's first stop is about a half an hour away, next to a pipeline tucked onto the back edges of a local farm. They park their van and turn on the equipment. A minute later, scientists Asia Ellis and Mark O'Mara see a spike on the levels on their computer screen.
So we know that it's natural gas.
Wow.
It's quite a large leak.
That is super big, yeah.
Yeah, 3.2 ppm.
That is super exciting.
It is exciting.
The team is picking up about 1.2 parts per million of methane, or about 12 times the amount they would normally see coming off of a well pad. Then they see the levels go even higher.
Just went up to 9 ppm.
Wow.
Wow.
So this is a leaky pipeline right here.
These readings could help Zimmerman and other researchers answer what's become an important question: how much natural gas is leaking into the atmosphere? One of the benefits of natural gas is that when it burns, it produces far less carbon dioxide than coal, a fuel that gas is rapidly replacing as a source for electricity. So if you're burning gas instead of coal, that's good from a climate change perspective. But there's a rub. Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas, so...
If you're not burning the natural gas, then, and you're releasing sort of pure methane into the atmosphere, the methane has a much higher global warming potential than carbon dioxide on like sort of a 25-year timescale.
Zimmerman's colleagues at Carnegie Mellon have found the EPA has been underestimating methane leak rates for years, but they're still not sure exactly how much of it is escaping the country's oil and gas system. Why can't they figure this out? One reason is the sheer number of places where gas can escape. Mark Bowling is a vice president for Southwestern Energy, one of Pennsylvania's largest natural gas producers.
Unlike other areas like, say, power plant emissions of CO2 from power plants, we're not talking about one big facility that you have one stack and says, well, there's your source, it's coming out there.
Instead, each step of the natural gas network contains hundreds of places where gas can escape. Bolling's company cooperated with the Environmental Defense Fund on several studies to better understand methane pollution. He says spending money on equipment that can prevent methane leaks is good business for his company.
That methane that we can save from going up into the air and going into our pipeline, whatever we get for that will help defray the cost.
The EPA and several states, including Colorado and Pennsylvania, have begun implementing methane regulations on the oil and gas industry. Bolling resists these types of regulations because, he says, they prescribe equipment for companies to use that may not be necessary or effective.
You're basically telling them I have 100 different sources, 20 of them are the problem, but I want you to replace all 100.
He says it's better to let companies decide how to reduce their own emissions. And there's evidence that companies are starting to take methane pollution seriously.
1, 0, +1, +2, +3.
That's audio from a satellite launch in India this June. Aboard the rocket was a satellite called Claire, equipped with high-resolution methane sensors. Stéphane Germain is CEO of GHGSat, the Montreal-based company that launched the satellite. His clients include ExxonMobil and Shell. Germain says these companies can make money with this data because in Canada, they're already subject to a carbon pricing system.
Industrial operators would be financially motivated to better understand their emissions so that they can control them and ultimately reduce them, because really what they're doing at that point is reducing their own financial risk.
Using satellites to measure greenhouse gases is a technique NASA has used for years. But with improving sensors, they may become more important in the search for methane leaks. Daniel Jacob is a Harvard climate scientist who uses satellites to measure methane in the atmosphere above the United States. Jacob says satellites could be an early warning system to help on-the-ground teams find and fix leaks.
Satellites can provide you with a detection. They can tell you, aha, you got a hot spot here. And then once you figure out from space that you have a hot spot, then you can dispatch ground-based instruments or maybe, you know, low-flying aircraft to figure out where this methane is coming from.
Jacob's last paper used satellite data with a resolution of 10 square kilometers. His current project is using Claire, which has a resolution of just 50 meters. Claire is scheduled to start sending methane readings back to Earth this fall. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Hundreds of miles of new pipelines are in the works to move natural gas from the shale formations in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio to markets across the country in the Northeast. That's opened a new front in the battle over fracking, compressor stations. So what's a compressor and why does it matter? The Allegheny Front's Joanna Richards explains.
300 people crowded into a school gym in Medina County, Ohio in February to lob questions, concerns, and some unvarnished anger at state environmental regulators.
Building this compressor station so close to people's homes speaks of greed over safety.
The Ohio EPA is not here on our side. We have to stand up.
The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency held this meeting as part of the permitting process for siting a compressor station along the planned Nexus pipeline. There are about 150 compressor stations in Ohio already, and state officials say there are about 15 new ones planned. Compressor stations are needed every 40 to 100 miles along pipelines to repressurize the gas and keep it moving. Like other industrial facilities, they are allowed to emit limited amounts of air pollutants. Ohio EPA and energy companies say the facilities are safe and well-regulated, but some people who live near them say the pollution is making them sick.
The dogs stick their nose to the door, turn around, and come right back in the house.
Barry Booth says his dogs gave him an early sign something was wrong with the air at his Carroll County home in eastern Ohio. In 2013, pipelines, wells, and compressor stations had sprouted up all around him. Booth, who's retired from manufacturing, didn't have a problem with this. He'd even signed a lease agreement with Chesapeake Energy to make some extra money. Then one day he went to get his wife, Mary Booth, a cup of coffee. He landed on the floor, nauseated and dizzy.
I jumped up to check on him and then ended up beside him. It was just really hard to breathe and the odor was very strong.
The Booths say they started having rashes, nosebleeds, and headaches. The couple blames air emissions from the nearby gas facilities, especially a big compressor station. That facility's permit allows it to emit limited amounts of carbon monoxide, volatile organic compounds, and particulates, among other pollutants. There hasn't been a lot of research on the health impacts from oil and gas development, especially focused on just compressor stations. So how worried should people be? That's what Trevor Penning is trying to figure out. He leads the Center for Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the University of Pennsylvania. Penning and some colleagues compared health trends in neighboring counties with and without heavy gas development. They analyzed all inpatient hospitalization records between 2007 and 2011, 92,000 records in all. Wayne County, without fracking, followed the national trend of declining hospital admissions. But in Susquehanna and Bradford counties, where gas extraction had taken off,
there was an increase in inpatient hospitalization rate, which comes out to be about 3% per year.
Penning says that's significant, and many of the health issues were things you'd expect from air pollution, like heart problems. His study didn't measure pollution levels or possible sources.
I actually feel that many residents who feel their health has been affected by this activity need to be listened to.
As more pipelines are built, more people outside drilling regions now find themselves near compressor stations too. That's why David Brown says it makes sense to try to single out these facilities for research. He's a public health toxicologist with the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, a research and advocacy group. It's funded in part by the Park Foundation, which also supports this reporting project. Brown heard complaints from people in the town of Minisink, New York. There was a compressor station there, but no other gas activity. He says the closest regional air sampling station, part of a federal monitoring network, showed pollution levels in compliance with federal standards. But when he did air monitoring in people's homes near the compressor station, particulate matter tested higher than the regional numbers. He also had residents keep health diaries, and Brown says there were problems.
When somebody's child wakes up with nosebleeds in the middle of the night regularly, then they know something is going wrong, although they're told that the child should be all right because the air standards aren't being violated.
Brown says the federal standards aim to improve overall regional air quality, but they're not designed to protect people from frequent close-range pollution exposure. Brown's research project was small, but he says his findings and others suggest compressor stations alone can be powerful polluters. Federal studies near two compressor stations in Pennsylvania found fine particulate matter and other pollutants at levels that could be harmful to people's health, although those studies, too, say their findings are limited. In Pennsylvania, regulators agree more data is needed. The state plans to install more air monitors in areas with compressor stations and gas wells next year. Some health advocates want more oversight of individual facilities, too. Right now, regulators rely mostly on companies' own emissions data. Mike Hopkins is with Ohio EPA's Division of Air Pollution Control.
It would be nice to be able to have an employee out at every single facility on a 24-hour basis to verify compliance. But the reality is that we can't afford to have that level of staffing.
And an industry spokesman says when it comes to compressor stations, activists are making a mountain out of a molehill. Jimmy Stewart is president of the Ohio Gas Association, a trade group.
Yes, there are some emissions from operating a compressor station. They pale in comparison to the emissions of a whole lot of other things that you are exposed to on a daily or weekly basis.
Stewart says people have less to fear from compressor stations than they do from traffic exhaust and gas station fumes. But Barry Booth, the man who lives near a compressor station in Carroll County, says he and his wife are so afraid for their health, after decades in this region, they're planning to move. A neighboring family settled a lawsuit with a company over a different compressor station. Now Booth, a former local union leader, is back to battling companies in retirement. In public meetings, he's urged people to fight new compressor stations.
That's what pisses me off. I would not be doing any of this if the company would be doing what they're supposed to be doing to the environment and everything. I would be out smelling the roses. I would be getting my paycheck from the gas and oil industry and everything.
The country wants the homegrown energy and jobs from oil and gas development. But Trevor Penning, the UPenn public health researcher, says it comes with a cost.
The EPA always works on not the concept of no risk, but acceptable risk. So the issue becomes is what is the acceptable risk here?
Penning says there's a huge need for more information about compressor stations to clarify what the risks actually are. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Joanna Richards.
Up next, we'll hear how all of this increased drilling is creating more of an incentive for gas companies to build even more pipelines that can transport natural gas across the country. But first, It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places, as some of you might know. This week, we're visiting a town that supposedly changed its name because of a reputation of the people who lived there. Was it Rowdy Kentucky, War West Virginia, or Knock 'em Stiff Ohio? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. Well, West Virginia might be considered wild and wonderful, but you'll find a place called Rowdy in Kentucky. So if you guessed Rowdy, Kentucky, you're right. One of our Twitter followers reached out a few weeks ago asking us to look into the story behind this town's name.
Hi, my name is Alexandra, and I used to live in Prestonsburg, Kentucky, but I often went down to visit my friends in London, Kentucky, and so I found myself driving back and forth on the Hal Rogers Parkway quite a bit. One sign that I could not help but chuckle at whenever I passed it pointed the way to two different communities. There were arrows pointing to Rowdy Dwarf. So I'd love to know what the origins are to a town named Rowdy and a town named Dwarf. Thanks so much.
And for help with this one, we got genealogist Carol Stidham on the phone.
Perry County Library, this is Carol. Can I help you?
Carol looked up the story in a book called Kentucky Place Names by Robert M. Rennick. And it goes something like this. Rowdy, Kentucky is a Perry County town just north of Hazard. The hamlet with post office extends for a half mile at the mouth of Rowdy Branch of Troublesome Creek. Well, for several years, the community was called Stacy for several local families. The post office adopted the name of Rowdy, which is said to have long reflected the wild character of its residents. So we wanted to know what the people in Rowdy did to get such a reputation. Well, Keith Roberts of Richmond, Kentucky, his grandmother grew up there. She told him that it was dangerous to drive there at night. She said, the boys and men there would ride cars fast, drink a lot, and get into meanness. She says the fellows would block the road, rob people, and a woman was raped. So that's quite a story about how Rowdy, Kentucky got its name. Special thanks to our Twitter follower, Alexandria, to giving us that idea for this What's in a Name segment and for giving us the idea for another one. But we're still looking for Dwarf, Kentucky. So if you could help us out with that one, send us a tweet at In Appalachia and we just might explore it inside Appalachia.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table.
Now onto our Appetite Appalachia segment. It's where we explore restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots. You know, every few years, Appalachian food gets rediscovered by mainstream media outlets as an up-and-coming culinary trend. But does that interest actually benefit those of us who actually live here as we navigate from a coal-fueled economy? Well, WFPL's Ashley Stevens looked at the pros and cons of the outside attention to Appalachia's other natural resource.
Chef Edward Lee, owner of the modern Southern restaurant 610 Magnolia, says that a few years ago, he developed an obsession with a particular food.
Chow chow.
Yep, chow chow. A pickled relish found in Appalachia that sometimes features green tomatoes, cabbage, and peas. It's a seemingly unexpected fixation for a Brooklyn-born chef of Korean descent. But Lee says that it's the result of something deeper.
You know, I come here and I learn about Southern food and I learn about these traditions and then I start to unravel questions and layers of sort of answers. And a lot of it draws me to Appalachia.
Lee isn't the only chef to feel this way. While Appalachia is shifting away from a coal-fueled economy, another of its natural resources, its food, is in the national spotlight. Earlier this year, the Washington Post published an article lauding humble Appalachian food as the next big thing in American regional cooking. But some who live in the region say that while this newfound attention could bolster the region's financial fortunes, it could also play into the same extraction economy that has drained Appalachia for decades. Ivy Brashear is a communications associate with the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development. Her work focuses on advocating for a regional shift toward an economy that relies on local assets.
What we're seeing a little bit of is folks sort of using the Appalachian brand and using Appalachian food as sort of a way to brand their own food and use it for their own benefit without not really benefiting the region at all.
That's where the Appalachian Food Summit comes in. The event was established in 2013 by founders Laura Smith, Travis Milton, Kendra Bailey Morris, and Ronnie Lundy. Smith says they organized the event after recognizing that Appalachia was becoming trendy again.
There was some kind of feeling of urgency, especially from some of our kind of founding members like Ronnie Lundy. You know, Appalachia gets discovered every couple of years again, or every couple of decades.
The summit draws all sorts, chefs, food writers, farmers, who discuss preserving and celebrating the cooking traditions that exist in Appalachia. They also talk about strategies for turning those traditions into income for residents. Smith says giving those in Appalachia the tools to grow, harvest, prepare, and promote their own food would lead to demand for a more dynamic regional workforce. And that, in turn, would provide jobs in the economically depressed area. But that's only if food professionals from within and outside the region borrow responsibly. Smith points to Lee and Travis Milton as good examples. Milton, who is the subject of the aforementioned Washington Post examination, plans to open his Appalachian-themed restaurant, Shovel and Pick, later this year in Bristol, Tennessee. Initially, he thought about opening in Richmond, Virginia, but he decided that would be extractive.
Me being outside of the region and putting that money into my pocket and the community seeing no real tangible benefit from it outside of the word Appalachia being mentioned in an article about me or something of that manner.
Milton said the region also needs to set itself up as a food destination, the way that cities like Charleston, South Carolina have.
In going to Charleston, you actually get to taste what Charleston is.
By copying this model, Milton says both tourists and chefs who want to learn about Appalachian cooking techniques would visit the region, something that Lee has done in his own cooking. Lee attended the Appalachian Food Summit, and he's traveled independently throughout the region. And while on one hand, he believes it's important to let culinary traditions develop outside of a regional bubble, he also says you have to take care and be respectful.
For me, it's always about being a student of the culture first before you try and adopt or do anything with it.
He says it's important to learn from the masters.
Whether it's people like Travis Milton or Laura Smith or Ronnie Lundy, who I'm very good friends with, you know, these people, I respect them a lot and I use them as guides.
Time will tell if other food pros will view the region in the same way. And just who will end up benefiting from their interest. I'm Ashley Stevens in Louisville.
Today, almost every major metropolitan area in the United States is supplied by or is the financial destination of one or more of the major interstate pipeline companies. And actually, already there is a huge concentration of pipelines right here in the Appalachian region of northern West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, and southern Ohio. As these and many other pending pipeline projects are headed for federal review, some residents across the region are questioning the safety. We heard stories of unmapped gas leaks along pipelines and compressor stations. Months after an interstate gas pipeline ruptured east of Pittsburgh, the question of safety is on the minds of many in the region. As the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports, the federal government is trying to ratchet up safety rules, but there are limits on what these new rules can do.
On the morning of April 29th, news helicopters circled a charred field in Salem Township, Westmoreland County, where just hours before a pipeline had exploded. It was the Texas Eastern Transmission Pipeline. When he got there, the heat from the flames was so hot, local fire chief Bob Rosati had to stay in his truck.
Now, that was the biggest fireball I've ever seen in my life. Thank God it was in a rural area where we're at, and it didn't pose that much of a problem. It could have been a lot worse if we were in a more populous area.
There was one person injured. 26-year-old James Baker was in his house a few hundred feet away from the blast. He was badly burned and his house destroyed. Investigators think external corrosion on the pipe caused the blast, but they're still investigating. The explosion comes as the federal government is trying to make transmission pipelines like the Texas Eastern safer, and also while the country is building more pipelines. The Department of Energy predicts Pennsylvania and Ohio will nearly double their natural gas production by the year 2030. So companies in the region are building more natural gas transmission lines, which carry gas at high pressure across long distances. Many in the path of these new pipelines are asking if they should be worried about accidents like what happened in Salem Township. At a public meeting a few weeks after the explosion, officials from Spectra Energy, which owns the Texas Eastern, addressed a roomful of sometimes angry residents. Here's company representative Devin Hotzel.
We're here sincerely. We want to answer these questions. We know there's questions. We may not have all the answers tonight because this is an ongoing process.
Many in attendance were used to living near pipelines and other gas infrastructure. Lisa Seguina leases out her land for around $20 a year to a company that stores gas under her property.
They need to do this safer. They need to find a safe way to move gas. I understand we need it. We need energy. I understand we need to frack. I get that. But there's safe ways to do it.
Seguina said what upset her the most was the fact that it took almost an hour for the company to shut off the gas in the pipeline after the explosion.
It was because they had to drive 15 miles to get to a valve to shut this off. So they said they first recognized that there was an issue, and then someone had to drive 15 miles to shut this valve off.
Spectra officials declined to be interviewed for this story, but in an email, a spokesman says the industry standard is to shut off pipelines within an hour of any incident. They also stressed that this pipeline met all federal inspection rules, including an inside-the-pipe inspection in 2012. Pipeline companies like to point out they are statistically safer than alternatives, like railroads or trucks. And the overall trend is that they've gotten safer over the past few decades. And yet, over the past 10 years, more than 300 serious pipeline incidents have resulted in 132 deaths, according to the U.S. Department of Transportation. And these accidents can often take place close to where people live. In fact, Rebecca Craven of the Watchdog Pipeline Safety Trust says there's no minimal setback for pipelines from homes and buildings established by the federal government.
There are situations where new pipelines are going through, and even with the ability to move away from a house or a group of houses, they are choosing to run a straight line and go close to those houses simply because it's cheaper or because there's a wetland that they'd have to get a wetland permit to go through.
Just down the road from where the Salem Township explosion happened, Rob Brown could be living very close to one of these pipelines soon. Dominion Transmission wants to put a large natural gas pipeline just down the hill from his back door.
It's about, I think, 200 feet.
When Brown first heard about the pipeline, he thought about moving, but then decided against it. The company says its pipelines are safe. But Brown says news of the explosion jolted him and raised the alert of people in this suburban neighborhood.
Something like that happens to a neighbor, the word spreads. It's not safe. There's definitely a risk.
The federal agency in charge of pipeline safety recently proposed new rules that may protect areas like Brown's neighborhood. The Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, or PHMSA, came out with the rules in response to a major explosion in San Bruno, California in 2010 that killed 8 people. As the rules are currently written, pipelines in densely populated areas undergo the most stringent safety inspections. But the feds are proposing to add protections for suburban and less populated areas, too, and add more pressure testing for older lines. A separate rule could mandate more use of automatic shutoff valves, which would have stopped the Salem Township fire sooner.
You know, it's a very deliberate, incremental process.
Stacy Gerard is former chief of pipeline safety at PHMSA and now works as a consultant. She says any new rule must pass a cost-benefit analysis. If the overall costs of imposing a rule outweigh the benefits from, say, avoiding property damage, injuries, even death, the government can't pass it. Gerard says that makes imposing safety regulations tough.
You know, there's things that actions, improvements that the agency would like to make that if they can't come out with a positive analysis, it won't make it into the rule. So there's no, you know, waving a magic wand and saying, okay, we're going to get this, all the improvements that we would like in this new rule. It's just not possible.
PHMSA did not respond to interview requests for this story. Gerard says most pipelines were built in places that once were rural and now are more developed. According to Gerard, More than 12,000 schools in the U.S. are now within 1,000 feet of a major natural gas transmission line. Given that proximity, she said, there will always be tension between sending gas around the country and keeping people near them safe. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
As the fracking industry moves into its next phase, there's been a big push to build new natural gas pipelines. Pipeline companies often get the power of eminent domain to take people's land for new lines since natural gas is considered a public need. In West Virginia and Virginia, there are two major pipeline projects in the works, the Mountain Valley and the Atlantic Coast. The proposed Mountain Valley Pipeline would carry fracked natural gas and run over 300 miles from West Virginia to Southern Virginia. It's expected to cross the private property of hundreds of different landowners, and some of them aren't happy about the possible path. Back in 2015, the Mountain Valley Pipeline Company sent letters threatening legal action to landowners who refused to allow surveyors onto their property. The company cited eminent domain. Eminent domain typically refers to the government's right to use private property for public good. Residents fought back and filed suit. The landowners were represented by the Appalachian Mountain Advocates. It's a nonprofit group of environmental lawyers. They argued that because the pipeline company doesn't provide a service to West Virginians, it doesn't have a right to eminent domain. Therefore, the lawsuit says, the pipeline company can't force landowners to allow surveyors onto their property. A Monroe County circuit judge agreed. The firm successfully prevented Mountain Valley Pipeline from entering private property in West Virginia. Now, in Virginia, the courts haven't followed suit, but the decision there is currently under appeal. Now the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, has pushed back the release of its draft environmental review of the pipeline until March 2017. This means the earliest construction could start is June of 2017. Another interstate pipeline project being proposed, called the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, or ACP, that one would run from north-central West Virginia to southern North Carolina. The proposed 550-mile pipeline is also still under FERC's review, and its construction start date was also delayed. Duke Energy and Dominion Energy are partnering on this pipeline proposal. Dominion says they hope the ACP pipeline will begin construction in the summer of 2017 as well. So now that we're up to speed on the ACP and the MVP, let's look into yet another product that's raising concerns from some folks. What happens when the proposed lines are carrying other products, like propane, butane, or ethane, byproducts of fracking? The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that some landowners are fighting back, saying these products are not in the public interest.
The quiet hills of eastern Ohio and Harrison County have become a popular spot, and not just for the cicadas you hear, but also for oil and gas development. Mick Luber grows his tomatoes, greens, even fava beans here at his organic farm and sells them at markets in Pittsburgh and Wheeling. He says recent years have brought a compressor station and multiple well sites so close they wake him up at night.
For the first year that they were fracking, it was hard for me to go outside. I felt so bad hearing the roar of all this stuff. It's nice to have the cicadas that drowned them out.
Now pipeline companies like Kinder Morgan are showing up. They came knocking on Luber's door.
They wanted to come right down through this main field and go up over top of that hill. There's a spring right up there. That's the most fertile part of this farm.
Marathon is already building a pipeline on the southern border of his farm. Luber points up to the valley where pipes are lined up waiting to be connected. The ground has been stripped bare.
This is what you end up with. This was all woods.
Shell is also planning a line here. So when Kinder Morgan showed up, Luber said no. No pipeline, not even a survey.
I told him I didn't want it.
Kinder Morgan sued. One of the main arguments in Luber's defense, the contents of Kinder Morgan's pipeline. Not natural gas for home heating, but to send ethane to Canada for Nova Chemicals to make plastics. Ethane, along with propane and butane, are known as natural gas liquids. They're byproducts of natural gas that's been fracked in the region. Increasingly, landowners are arguing that they shouldn't have to give up their property rights for companies to transport these liquids to make plastics, especially if they're being sent to foreign countries. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Fore says, yes, they should. Plastics are in the public interest.
You tell me anybody in this country that doesn't use plastics in some way and that plastics aren't critically important to their everyday lives, from cups to medical devices, to automobiles.
You might think the federal government would have a say in whether transporting these natural gas liquids to make plastics is important enough to usurp individual property rights. If this were a natural gas pipeline, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, would have authority over siting its route. But what about these liquids like ethane?
FERC has no authority to regulate natural gas liquids in the United States at all.
Attorney Rich Raiders represents about a dozen landowners in Pennsylvania against eminent domain action from a different pipeline company, Sunoco Logistics. He says when FERC has authority, as it does for siting natural gas pipelines, landowners have a say in how it's routed.
That's an all public, eyes open discussion, whereas for natural gas liquid line, that's between the individual landowner and the pipeline operator, and no government entity is involved at all.
Well, the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration does require permits for large earth disturbances and around bodies of water for pipeline routes. But when it comes to eminent domain, that's being decided in state courts. The Kentucky Supreme Court recently let a lower court ruling stand. It found that the pipeline company in that case is not a public utility, which means it does not have the power of eminent domain to site a natural gas liquids pipeline. In Pennsylvania, pipeline companies that want eminent domain power also have to get certified as a public utility by the State Public Utility Commission, the PUC. To do that, they have to show that their project will benefit the people of the Commonwealth, and what that means is under debate. One of the biggest headline grabbers on this issue has been Sunoco's Mariner East project. It includes two pipelines, an older one that's been repurposed and a newer one, both carrying natural gas liquids. The new line begins in Ohio near McLuber's farm in Harrison County, runs through Pennsylvania to the Marcus Hook Industrial Complex on the Delaware border near Philadelphia. From there, Rader says the propane is being shipped to Europe.
That's not a need of the Commonwealth.
And so he argues Sunoco should not have the power of eminent domain. The company would not record an interview for this story. In an email to the Allegheny Front, Sunoco says the project will provide propane for heating fuel to markets in Pennsylvania. Sunoco says for the Mariner East 2 pipeline, it's a utility, based on a certification granted by the PUC to their older pipeline back in the 1930s. Some are fighting that stance in court, and a state appeals court recently sided with Sunoco. Pennsylvania's Commonwealth Court ruled in July that the company is a public utility and that that power extends to all 17 counties along the pipeline's path. Sunoco's email says still they've come to agreement with the majority of landowners. Attorney Nicholas Anderson represents a landowner in Harrison County that's in Ohio. The Teeter family is fighting Sunoco's eminent domain action.
The bottom line is that when they're approaching landowners in Ohio, they have this big stick called eminent domain. And so they say, look, we'll give you X number of dollars per linear foot, but if you don't accept that, we're just going to take your property. And that is where we have a problem.
Anderson says along that Kinder Morgan ethane pipeline from Ohio to Canada, the one farmer Mick Luber was fighting, the company recently filed 130 eminent domain cases in at least 8 Ohio counties. Kinder Morgan spokesperson Alan Forrest says they only take eminent domain action as a last resort.
If you look at our route, you can see a lot of zigs and zags and turns, certainly not a straight line. Those are all based upon big issues like avoiding environmentally sensitive areas or individual landowner concerns.
Like McLuber, Kinder Morgan recently announced they would reroute around his farm. Still, Luber doesn't see it as a victory.
Well, as long as these guys are still doing this stuff, what is the victory, you know? You can't stop the vigilance, you know? People got to keep standing in their way.
Kinder Morgan says Luber got what he wanted, but the company wants to make it clear they can't reroute for every landowner who has a problem with their pipeline. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
On today's show, we've been looking at issues related to pipelines, following natural gas as it's extracted and moved to our homes, and some of the byproducts that come with it. Sometimes there's just more fuel being produced than people need, whether because of the market glut we've heard about, or just because it's warm and people really don't need heating fuel. And so energy companies store it. There are more than 400 underground storage facilities in the U.S., like old mines and depleted aquifers. And that's how some residents and wineries in the Finger Lakes region of New York got involved in a long-term standoff with Crestwood Equity Partners. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited Seneca Lake to look at Crestwood's plan to store natural gas and propane from Pennsylvania and Ohio in the salt caverns there.
Driving around Seneca Lake, evidence of industry is everywhere.
You have to try our rosé.
The wine industry, that is. There are fields upon fields of grapevines, with wineries and tasting rooms nestled along the lakeside, like this one.
My name is Lou Damiani. I'm co-owner of Damiani Wine Cellars here on beautiful Seneca Lake.
Damiani grew up around here. He and his partner started clearing land and planting grapes in the early 1990s.
And realized the revolution that was taking place here in the grapes we could grow and the wines we could produce.
In recent years, internationally known vintners have moved to the Finger Lakes. The industry has blossomed into more than 100 wineries, distilleries, and breweries. It's been named a top destination for wine lovers. Still, Damiani has kept his job at Cornell University.
It's a struggle. It's a tough, competitive business. And every little thing matters in this business. The main part of it is tourism.
Tourism. It's a $3 billion a year industry in the Finger Lakes, employing nearly 60,000 people. On the late spring weekend, I visited the town of Watkins Glen on the southern edge of the lake was packed. And the nearby state park, it's one of the most visited in the country. We could barely squeeze through some spots. There were so many people taking selfies. Many tourists come to taste and buy wine. They also boat and fish on Seneca Lake, a deep and salty lake that supplies drinking water to 100,000 people. Looking out the tasting room window over the grapevines, Damiani points across the lake to the U.S. salt plant. He and others who work and live here worry about a plan under consideration by the New York Department of Environmental Conservation to store natural gas, propane, and butane in the salt caverns. This is the sound of salt being packaged and shipped out at the plant in Watkins Glen for pharmaceuticals, cleaning, and just regular table salt. Salt has been mined under Seneca Lake for over 100 years. The company that's now called Crestwood bought U.S. Salt in 2008. Crestwood declined an interview for this story, but they got me in touch with Mike Gilbert, a union worker at the plant.
I work in the shipping department. I've been here for about 15 years now.
I caught up with Gilbert around 8 a.m. during his second shift. He says to get the salt, they pump millions of gallons of water down thousands of feet into the caverns at high pressure. The salt dissolves in the water, and then they pump it back up.
Well, yeah, it's a brine. Brine is a liquid. It looks just like water. You wouldn't know unless you actually taste it that it's very salty.
The brine is stored in open ponds or pits. It's heated to evaporate the water. Crestwood wants to use the salt caverns to store fuels.
What they're proposing to do is put propane down in there.
1.5 million gallons of propane, as well as 600,000 gallons of butane. The company already stores natural gas in the salt caverns and wants to expand that capacity. Gilbert says the United Steelworkers support the project. Crestwood plans to add up to 17 full-time jobs.
I would love to be able to give 17 people the same chance that I've had to raise my family. If 17 more people could do that in this area, that'd be phenomenal.
But a lot of people don't think it's worth the risk.
We are Seneca Lake!
More than 600 people have been arrested protesting Crestwood during the years its storage plans have been under consideration. They regularly stand at Crestwood's front gates with signs like Make Love, Not Methane, and We Are Seneca Lake. Anti-fracking activist David Braun of California recently joined them.
I am risking arrest with you all today because of disasters with gas storage that I have seen up close. Don't let it happen here.
Braun is talking about the huge leak from Aliso Canyon, where they store gas in depleted oil fields. It spewed methane into the air for nearly 4 months before being plugged in February.
Like the facility here at Seneca Lake, the Aliso Canyon facility was created from unlined holes in the ground that were never engineered to store anything, let alone highly pressurized, flammable gas.
The New York DEC found last year that opponents have not provided adequate proof to back up their concerns about Crestwood's plans, although it hasn't given final approvals for the project. And the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has already approved the natural gas expansion project.
And so based on that, I don't know why it just can't get going. It's really a political situation.
I met Philip Barnes, a retired security officer, on the docks in downtown Watkins Glen. He's a legislator in Schuyler County, where this is all being debated.
It's totally up to the governor to make a decision. And it's been 6, 7, 8 years now in the making.
Governor Andrew Cuomo banned fracking in New York a couple of years ago. This spring, the DEC denied water permits for the Constitution natural gas pipeline from Pennsylvania to Albany. Opponents of Crestwood's plans want the DEC to continue this anti-fracking trend. They say the company is trying to make Seneca Lake a hub for fracked fuels from Pennsylvania to supply the entire Northeast, and they want the administration to stop it. Many are worried about the project's impact on water quality.
Sawmill Creek Vineyards, this is Tina.
Tina Haslett manages a vineyard here that's been in her husband's family since 1852.
We're already, Seneca Lake is the saltiest lake in the Finger Lakes, and it's because of those salt caverns.
Haslett points to research that shows moving pressurized fuels into and out of the salt caverns could push the salinity of the lakes even higher.
They're telling people, if you're young or elderly or have had blood pressure, don't drink this water. This is the water source for over 100,000 people. There's no other water source. So, you know, what are people supposed to do?
Geologist John Halfman lives here and has been studying the salinity issue in Seneca Lake for 25 years. He agrees with the DEC. Storing fuels in the salt caverns should be safe.
If everything goes as planned, nothing's going to happen, in which case I think it's a good idea. If there is some unfortunate mistake, then it's a horrible idea.
The DEC would not comment for this story. Crestwood and the community are awaiting their permitting decisions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Special thanks to the Allegheny Front for these reports. The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. That's our show today. Don't forget to check out the special TV episode of Inside Appalachia, now available to watch on our website. That's at wvpublic.org. And let us know what you think. Thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front, WFPL in Louisville, and NPR's All Things Considered. Music in today's show is also provided by Ben Townsend, Andy Agnew Jr., and Dog and Gun. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, or at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a News and Public Affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.